Today's Taisho will be on case 31 in the Pien Lu, the Blue Cliff Record, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 31 is entitled Meoku Comes to Shokei. Engo's introduction. With subconscious stirring, images appear. With awareness, ice forms. Even if there is no stirring and no awareness, you have not yet escaped the confinement of the fox's hole. If you truly penetrate in your practice and become master of it, you will experience not a trace of obstruction. You will be like a dragon, supported by deep waters, like a tiger that commands its mountain retreat. Then, if you let go, even tiles and pebbles become illuminating. If you hold fast, even gold loses its luster. And the koans of the old masters will become tedious. Tell me, what am I talking about? See the following. Main subject. Meoku came to Shokei, carrying his bell staff with him, walked around Shokei's seat three times, shook his staff, ringing the bells, stuck it in the ground, and stood up straight. Kei said, good. Meoku then came to Nansan, walking around Nansen's seat, shook his staff, ringing the bells, and stuck it in the ground, and stood up straight. Nansen said, wrong. Meoku said, what? Shokei said, good. Why do you say wrong? Nansen said, Shokei is good, but you are wrong. You are blown about by the wind. That will lead to destruction. Secho's verse, this mistake, that mistake, never take them away. In the four seas, the waves subside, 100 rivers flow quietly to the sea. The 12 bells of the staff tinkled up high. Empty and silent is the road to the gate. No, no, not empty and silent. The enlightened person must take medicine for the illness of having no illness. So I want to thank everyone for coming to practice this morning. People were sitting very still this morning. Some people arrived here at 7. Some people came at 8 and some at 9:30 and some have just come now. And I thank you all for coming here to practice together. It's really quite wonderful to sit with other people, and it's really wonderful we have this opportunity to practice so deeply together. This has worked out so well, and I'm very grateful to the Adventures of Zoom for this making this practice possible. When we first started sitting online last March, we had been shut down for about 3 weeks, so it was difficult to know whether we would have practice at all. I didn't really know anything about Zoom, and Rutgers was just starting to explore another application called WebEx. Some of you might know about WebEx. And I tried it in my class, and it didn't work very well for a number of reasons. So we went to Facebook, and Facebook, it was something I knew how to use, so it was simple, and I discovered that you could actually live stream on Facebook, which is something I had never wanted to do, and it was something I didn't know how to do. I tried to do it a couple times, and it didn't work, I had to educate myself a little bit about Facebook, and then we started using Facebook. So for the first month or so, we were using Facebook, but then, you know, Facebook does strange things. You know, for example, if the video runs too long, they'll just shut it down. The live stream, they'll just close the live stream. And I went online and I researched, and they seemed to be closing the live stream in ways that didn't comport with their own rules. It just arbitrarily, the live stream would end. So, you know, I tried different strategies. Even now, we are using Zoom, but we're also using Facebook. And I have to shut Facebook down each after each sit, basically, and start it up again so Mark Zuckerberg doesn't shut us down mysteriously.
Right.
And so, you know, we found Zoom and we migrated to Zoom. But, you know, there are problems with Zoom, too. You know, during our first session, we had a Zoom session. And I didn't know the rule that you can't you can't occupy two different Zoom meetings at the same time. And so we tried to do Dokusan, and everybody was ready to go to Dokusan, and I opened the Dokusan line, and it wiped out the sit. It made our virtual Zendo disappear, and everybody was hanging in space in the void. So why am I talking about this? Well, you know, it never works exactly right. You know, there's always a problem. I was happy to see about 2 months ago that Zoom actually went down, like in England and parts of the East Coast and the Northeast. And it even was acting strange here. It was doing strange things. It didn't go completely down, but it went down on parts of the European continent and so on. You know, so, you know, when I first started working with this technology, I so wanted it to be, I so wanted to have my act together. You know, I so wanted, I'm not a techie. I don't know a lot about this. And Alex, I'm very grateful to Alex and to Nagalinga, you know, for getting us through. And Alex would send me little emails, like he'd send me an email. I'd be in Zoom and he'd send me an email and he'd say, "You're muted," you know. So, oh, I didn't forget about, you know, or I'd get a message in Facebook that would say something about what I wasn't doing, you know. So he helped me. I wanted it to go smoothly. I wanted everything to be efficient and effective, but there was always some problem, right? You know, obviously I care a lot about Zen, you know. It's the most important thing in my life. And, you know, I go to bed thinking about Zen. I get up thinking about Zen. I practice Zen. And when I'm at work, I'm doing my job. But, you know, Zen is always right there, you know. So I wanted it to go well. But, you know, it never quite goes well. Something always messes it up. And we've gotten better, you know. We know the drill, but, you know, tomorrow Zoom will make some change and suddenly that'll be challenging again. Nobody likes when that happens. We'd all like to be, you know, master of the internet. But, you know, even masters of the internet are not masters of the internet. And maybe that's not such a bad thing. You know, if you think about the life, if you think about the Buddha, you know, we think about the Buddha, there's a statue of the Buddha right here on the altar. You can't see it, but it's a beautiful statue. It was made in India and it's bronze and it's really in fact, I think it was made in Nepal and it's really beautiful. A member in our group donated it a long time ago and it's just gorgeous. You know, when we have the statue of the Buddha on the altar, it looks so beautiful, and sometimes I'll be able to see it where I'm sitting, catching the light from, we're not allowed to have a candle in this room, but we have an electric candle, and it'll catch the light from the electric candle. It's so beautiful, so serene, right? And when we think of the Buddha, you know, you think serene. You know, that if you go on Facebook, there's all these on your feed, on your stream, there will be all these phony quotes from the Buddha that he never said, and it'll have a beautiful serene picture of the Buddha. And I'm glad people are interested in the Buddha. The phony quotes I'm not so excited about, but the thing is, we think serene. But if you look at the life of the Buddha, it wasn't serene, you know. So, you know, the Buddha was raised to be a political leader and was part of the warrior caste in India. He wasn't a Brahmin, he was a Kshatriya. And he was educated to be a political leader, and he was trained to be like a warrior, you know. So sometimes if you read the early Buddhist sutras, he uses metaphors from his training. He'll talk about riding a horse or shooting an arrow and so on. So, you know, he was basically, his father was probably, in Buddhist legend, they say that the Buddha's father was a king, but actually the Shakya people didn't have a king. They had a parliamentary government. And it's probably the case that the Buddha's father was like a speaker of the parliament or something like that. He was a tribal leader, a clan leader, we could say. Like in Scotland and Japan, there are these big families, right? And the Buddha's family was one of these big families. And his father was in parliament, basically a leader in the parliament. But he was raised to be a warrior. And we know from the stories that he decided not to do what his father wanted him to do. His father trained him to be a political person, trained him to be a soldier, basically. He got married, he had a child, and then he had this experience, right, where he realized, you know, he was shaken by his encounter with, according to the story, somebody who was sick, somebody who was old and a dead body. And, you know, in the story about the Buddha, it says he had never seen them before, but that's impossible. But what probably happened was that he's living this life where he's going along with everybody's expectations. He's doing what dad and mom said, and he's it's all going well for him, right? He's happy, he's got a nice place, he's married. And then he has this experience where he realizes, you know, is this real? Is this real? You know, everybody says this is real, but is it real? Because, you know, behind the curtain is this, you know, people are going to die. We're all going to die. Sickness, old age, nobody likes, you know, falling apart day after day. And he had, like we would say, a personal crisis. And he left home. He abandoned his family, and he went to study with these gurus, with these meditation teachers. And the Pali Sutras, the early sutras, say that his parents were inconsolable. You know, they begged him not to go. And in one of the Pali Sutras, it said they sobbed. You know, they were sobbing when he left. So it must have been a difficult transition, right? I mean, you know, the story doesn't tell us about the arguments he must have had with his parents or with his wife, and abandoning his child, his son. You know, that's difficult, right? And it must have felt really messy and confusing, right? And if we say, oh, well, the Buddha always knew he was the Buddha, I don't believe that. You know, I think it must have been very hard for him. You know, he's haunted by this a sense that, you know, the way we're living is not real, and it's not liberating, you know, and it's not freeing, you know, and acting on that insight, you know, in the face of all this criticism and in the face of all this resistance, you know, everybody said, no, don't do it. You know, are you crazy? You know, so Siddhartha, the young Buddha, you know, must have had a lot of arguments with his parents. He left. People in his town must have said, you're a bum, you know, what's wrong with you? You know, he goes off and he studies with these gurus who were really quite distinguished. Eventually the Buddha had a great awakening experience. He tried to starve himself to death because that's what people believed might lead to enlightenment. And he was almost dead, and he realized this is probably not working out. And he left his five companions who were on this fast. It was like they're going to fast to death or wake up. And he met a little girl from one of the farms nearby, and she made rice and milk for him. And he ate the rice and milk, and it was like medicine. It restored his strength. He goes back to meditate on his own, and he meditates all night. And in the morning, he sees the morning star, and he has his Dai Kensho experience. He sees Buddha nature, we would say. It's such a world-shaking experience that he doesn't think anybody will ever understand. Nobody's ever going to understand. When I try to describe this, nobody's going to get it. And the sutra says that like a spirit, nature spirit, appeared named Sahampati and said, listen, don't think that way. There are people who will understand this. You need to help the world. There's suffering everywhere we turn. So you need to help. So the Buddha did. And for the next 50 years, he dedicated himself to that. But it was never easy. The sutras say that when he left after he had enlightenment and he went back to see his five companions, they didn't immediately go, oh, your face is so radiant. We know you've had enlightenment. They didn't believe him at first. And actually, on his way to find them, he runs into a person on the road who knows him. So he's had his great awakening experience, and he runs into this guy, and this person knew him from his studies with these meditation masters. And the Buddha says, I've done it. I've wakened up. And in the sutra, the guy says, oh, yeah, that's great. That's great. Sure you have, right? And moves on. So, actually, the Buddha had a hard time carrying out his mission all his life. People tried to assassinate him, actually. His own cousin tried to kill him, but other people tried to assassinate him. And some of his best students were murdered, actually. This is something... the usual stories don't tell about, but if you read the sutras, all of this is the case, So it was a fight every day to help people wake up. The Buddha would run into people who would make fun of him, who would insult him, and every day he would just get up and he would teach the Dharma, and he would try to communicate to people how to wake up in this life. Right, how to wake up, try to communicate to people his insight and carry out his promise to Sahampati and to humanity. And, he was actually very successful. But he was so successful that created problems. So, once the Buddha got going, people began to listen to him. And they began to realize that this is really different. He's not telling us to make offerings to Brahma. He's not telling us, that if we make offerings to the gods, things are going to be good for us. What he says is, liberate yourself from your attachments and your fears, right? And people began to like this. In fact, so many people began to join the Sangha that parents and basically, rich landowners saw their sons and daughters going off to join the Sangha, and people were worried, well, who will work in the mines? Who will work in the factories? Parents felt that their children were deserting them, right? And so on. So, it created a lot of problems that the Buddha was so effective and persuasive, and that people had these Dai Kensho experiences. And they would attest and say, I did what the Buddha said, and I've had this experience. I've experienced what he called the deathless. I've experienced the deathless. And people who didn't understand this or want to understand this, in some ways they became the Buddha's opponents. You know, they became his critics. You know, tried to keep the Buddha eventually had to agree that you could only join the Sangha if your parents gave you permission, because so many people were complaining to the authorities that their kids were running off and joining the Sangha. During the Buddha's lifetime, his own nation, the Shakya Republic, got involved in a military conflict with a military dictatorship, Kosala, next door. And four times the Kosalan army invaded the Buddha's homeland, the Shakya Republic. And the sutras say, you know, the Buddha was in the middle like of a sesshin, and he heard about this and he got up and he left and he went and he met the army of Kosala. And in the army, there were people who knew him personally, and there were even people who were his students. And he said, please don't do this. This is a terrible mistake. You will regret this. And the sutras say the army turned back, I guess it was twice. And the third time, the Buddha was away. He was in another place teaching. And they came in and they destroyed the Shakya Republic. When we imagine the life of the Buddha, right, we think of the Buddha sitting in the forest meditating serenely, which he did. But on the other hand, it was never, the world was a conflicted place. It was a crazy place, right? If you read the life of the Buddha, you realize how around him, all of this chaos and all of this disorder and unhappiness was swirling all the time. And I mentioned that his own cousin tried to kill him on several occasions. So, you know, once the Sangha got going, some of the Buddha's close family members were actually in the Sangha. So Ananda, if you read the sutras, there's usually this character named Ananda. Ananda was the Buddha's personal attendant, and he's with the Buddha almost all the time. And after the Buddha died, Ananda was sort of like a genius. He had this incredibly retentive mind, and he remembered, he could almost verbatim remember everything the world honored one said. That was the Buddha's cousin. That was his father's brother's son, Ananda. But other members of the Sangha were also from the Buddha's clan or tribe or immediate family. And one of them was another cousin named Devadatta. And as the Sangha got going, you know how these things work, right? You know, the Buddha had like five students, and then suddenly he started gathering a lot of people who would listen to him. Pretty soon, there's a lot of monks and a lot of nuns, right? And nuns and monks don't always behave well. So there's a scandal, right? Somebody sleeps with somebody. This kind of thing goes on. And then the people accuse the Sangha of being a den of iniquity, and so on and so on. And so the Buddha had to navigate all this. He's criticized for what he's doing. And then meanwhile, Devadatta is jealous of his cousin. And Devadatta decides that he should be running the Sangha. And he tries to push the Buddha out. And when the Buddha decides not to turn everything over to Devadatta, Devadatta hatches a plot to kill him. And he actually sent assassins to the Buddha. And the Buddha, according to the sutras, talked the assassins out of killing him. You know, and when the assassins met him, they thought he was such a nice man. They decided not to kill him. And the assassin said to the Buddha, look, you know, if we don't kill you, we're going to be killed. And the Buddha said, well, here's what you have to do. You have to leave now and don't come back, and I'll send you to some friends and they will hide you. So the Buddha survived several assassination attempts. He lived through basically the destruction of his homeland. And there were, there were all these intrigues and scandals. His best friend, King Bimbisara, was a really wonderful human being who loved the Dharma and loved the Buddha. And Bimbisara had a son who was a power mad person, and he actually overthrew his father and starved his father to death, right? He didn't actually murder him, he just kept him in a room with no food. So this was the world that the Buddha was living in. And it's possible when we think about the Buddha to imagine this great serenity, but every day something was going wrong. You know, every day something was going wrong. It was a chaotic situation from beginning to end, okay? And, you know, what made the Buddha exceptional was that he wasn't overcome by all this chaos and all this venality and brutality and hatred, right? You know, the other side of the story is that he got up every... The Buddha had his great awakening experience when he was 35 years old. So for the next 50 years, he would go all over northeastern India, going into these villages, talking to people, showing them how to practice the great way, and they would have awakening experiences to varying degrees. So, you know, the Buddha was able to get up every morning, sit down, and do just what we did this morning. You know, he would, you know, after his enlightenment experience, he continued to practice every day. And he would get up in the morning and meditate. And then he would go out with monks and nuns and beg for food. And then he would come home, and the afternoon was spent meeting with people like Dokusan, right? He would meet King Bimbisara, his old friend. And the prime minister of his country would come to talk to him for advice. And, you know, one time the Buddha even was invited to the parliament of the Shakya Republic. And he was quite old at that time, but he gave the inaugural address to the new building. So, you know, the afternoon was spent advising people and helping them with their lives. People would come with their personal crises. And then, you know, in the evening, he would go back to meditation. And the sutras say the Buddha would sleep 1 hour a night. Please don't do this. People need more. Unless you're the Buddha, you need more sleep than that. But the Buddha would sleep 1 hour a night, and everything else was meditation and helping other people. And he could descend into enlightenment, right? He could sit down on the cushion, do just what we did this morning, you know, sitting still for long periods of time. And he would, you know, just like us, there'd be thoughts, you know, things going on that Devadatta's trying to kill me. What should I do? Will he hurt the other monks? And so on. Then he descends down and he begins to enter samadhi, deep meditative concentration. And then he enters shunyata, mushin, right? And he works down through the layers of the mind. And because he's had daikensho, you know, he sits in enlightened mind, you know. Until people have that experience, they sit on, you could say, on top of enlightened mind, facing that emptiness, right? And gradually the boundary between ourselves and enlightened mind wears away or opens up, and little by little, until that we have, like you could say, unbroken access to that, right? So the Buddha would do that, and then he would get up, beg for his food, come back and help people with their problems, help monks and nuns meditate better, help business people cope with their moral challenges, and so on and so on. But never easy, always challenging, things always going wrong, right? So now I'll get to the koan, right? Meoku came to Shokei carrying his bell staff with him, walked around Shokei's seat three times, shook his staff, ringing the bells, stuck it in the ground, stood straight up, and Kay said, or Show Kay said, good. See? So, Show Kay is in Mandarin, that's Zhang Jing. Zhang Jing. Zhang Jing is Show Kay, great Tang Dynasty master. And Nansen is Nanchuan. So, anyway, Meiyoku has this, I think in Mandarin he's Maku is what he's called in Mandarin, but he has Daikensho experience, right? And he, after the experience, he says, I've got to go tell my Dharma brothers, Shokei and Nansen, that I've had this experience. And he goes many miles to find Shokei's temple. And he finds Shokei's temple, and he's carrying his pilgrim staff. So this staff is in ancient India and China. When you went on a trip, if you were a monk or a nun and you went on a trip, you carried a staff that actually had a trident. This is an ancient Indian symbol of perfection. In the West, you know, Neptune carries a trident, and Western people inherited the myth, but they lost track of what it meant. The trident is a symbol of perfection or completeness. And in ancient India, Buddhist pilgrims would carry a trident, and on each of the prongs of the trident, there would be some bells, little bells. So pilgrims would carry this trident, and Meiyoku carries the trident to Shokei's temple. And when he gets to Shokei's temple, he walks into the Zendo. Shokei's meditating, and Meiyoku walks three times around Shokei, who's sitting there, and then he stands in front of Shokei, and he takes the he rings the bells, and hits the floorboards with his staff, and it says that Shokei looks up and says, "Good, good." So basically, this guy's had a Daikensho experience. He has arrived, you could say. He feels like, I've done it. You know, I've done it. And he goes to his elder Dharma brother and makes a big display of his attainment, right? His elder Dharma brother looks and understands what's happened and says, good, good. So, you know, basically, as I understand it, the etiquette was that he should have gone in and walked three times around his Dharma brother and then waited for his Dharma brother to respond to him. But instead, he stands straight and rings his bells and hits the floor. So it's sort of a little self-assertive gesture. Anyway, after he presents to Shokei, he goes to Nansen. And so he does another pilgrimage. He walks across the countryside. He gets to Nansen's temple. He goes into the Zendo. Nansen's sitting in the Zen hall. He goes three times around, and he hits the floor, and he stands up, and Nansen looks up and says, "Wrong, wrong." And Meiyoku is thunderstruck, right? And he says, "But Shokei said good." And Nansen says, "You don't get it." He says, "Shokei, that is Shokei's way of manifesting. He says good to everything. He says good to famine. He says good to, you know, basically the roof falling in. That's his practice. No matter what happens, it's good." See? But you are wrong. And he said, and if you don't understand what I'm saying, you're on the road to destruction. So you know, one way to think about enlightenment and Zen practice in general is that our job is to free ourselves from birth and death. Free ourselves from birth and death. So actually, we say that sometimes. I want to be free from birth and death. That's a Buddhist formulation. You know, if I only could have daikensho, you know, I would be free from all of these problems. Right? I'd be free from all this stuff. And it's possible to imagine enlightenment is like that, right? So, you know, no matter what happens, if you're fully awake, everything's going to be perfect. It's going to be perfect. There's not going to be any problems. Everything's going to be wonderful. So that's a kind of fantasy. It's actually a fantasy. You know, for the enlightened person, always the way is, you know, it's like flowers the whole way. That's a fantasy, and it's actually a destructive fantasy. And you see it as a destructive fantasy in cases where, there have been a number of scandals in the Buddhist world. I don't know if you're familiar with them, and if you are not, good, take my word for it. If you know about them, there's these cases where, like, very distinguished teachers do things that are really bad. You know, they have sex with their students. They are abusive, you know, to their students and so on. There was a teacher named, what's his name? His name is escaping me right now, but he was very, he wrote the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying. Beautiful book. When it came out, I just thought, this is a fantastic book. It turned out that he not only slept with his students, but he was physically abusive to his students. And you think, how can this happen? But I think I know how it happens, you know. I think people use enlightened mind or use samadhi mind to deceive themselves, if this is making any sense. You know, instead of seeing my own faults, my own problems, I can retreat into this place that's very serene, very clear and enlightenment-like, and say, oh, I have no problems. I have no problems. Another example is, you know, there was one teacher I know who actually was a very nice man, but his whole community was like fighting all the time, and there were all these power struggles, and this guy was like oblivious to it. But you know, to be oblivious to that, you have to work hard to be oblivious, right? I hope I'm making some sense, but you know, human beings have conflicts, human beings have rivalries and jealousy, and if you think of yourself as like, I'm the perfect teacher, I have no problems, I've worked through all my stuff, and I have the perfect sangha, everybody's perfect, 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 perfect. See, I can't deal with my problems, and I can't deal with their problems. It's like parents can be like this, right? You know, my sister has two sons, and in my sister's eyes, her sons can do no wrong, right? It's just because, why? I love my sister. Don't tell her I said this. But, you know, basically, my sister wants to be the perfect mother. And the perfect mother has perfect sons. But there are no perfect sons. And therefore, there are no perfect mothers. So, you know, if your image of yourself is the perfect mother and you have to have perfect sons, what won't you see? You won't see the bullshit of your sons, right? You won't see the bullshit of your sons. And you have to be a good parent, you have to say, hey, that's a problem. I have to deal with this problem. And as soon as you deal with the problem, you have to say, I'm not the perfect mother. See? It's like, there are teachers like this too. You know, I will meet people who are teachers who are actually really terrible teachers, and their students love them. And if you ask the students, what do you think of the teacher? They'll say, oh, he's fantastic. I learned so much. But when you talk to the students, you realize they didn't learn so much. They were in like a mutual admiration society. It's like a mutually supporting delusion, right? To be a good teacher, you have to get up at night and think, oh my God, my students are not learning anything, you know? In order to do that, you have to be willing to say, I'm not the perfect teacher, see? Okay. So there's a real danger in loving perfection, loving serenity, loving peace, wanting wholeness, wanting unity, right? Wholeness. Everywhere I look is wholeness, right? Not so. You know, everywhere I look, I see contradictions. Everywhere I look, I see conflict, you know? So if you don't see the contradictions, if you don't see the wholeness, you're blocking, you're ignoring something that's crucially important. You know, when the Buddha had his Daikensho experience, he could have just said, all is one. All is one. And he could have stayed up on that mountain, if he was on a mountain. I don't think he actually was. He could have stayed in the forest, and he could have meditated every day and just been with this enlightened mind. But, you know, the Buddha made a choice not to do that, because that's not real enlightenment, right? To realize that, to be awake, and then to realize that around you there's suffering, means that you have to like roll up your sleeves and get out there and do something about it. And for the Buddha, doing something about it meant, you know, being criticized, made fun of, assassination attempts, etc. You know, it was difficult the whole way, but he got up every morning and he sat down on the cushion and he descended into deep wuxin and then into a lighted mind, and he brought that out into the world. But we have a false picture if we think that what we're doing is to get free from birth and death. See, birth and death, that never ends, and enlightened mind never ends. And our job is to bring enlightened mind into birth and death every time we can, every minute of the day, actually. And that's what the Buddha did. So Myoku is in like a spiritual trap, you could say. You know, he's now had his Daikensho and he's walking on the clouds and he thinks it's over for me. You know, I've solved all the problems. I'm free. But do you see, you can see the selfishness of that, right? The selfishness of that. That's not enlightenment. That's actually the opposite. You know, if you're truly awake, you realize everything is my responsibility, right? And no individual wakes up, you know. The world wakes up through individuals, you could say. You know? And when the Buddha woke up, you know, the first thing he confronts, according to the sutras, is the problem of suffering humanity. And so he sets off to do something. And the problem with Myoku is he's in the fantasy now that he's above all that, or he's free from all. And he goes to his Dharma brother, Shokei, or Zhangjing, and Zhangjing knows that the world is a tough place, and so the way Zhangjing responds to everything is like Gu Tae's one finger. Zhangjing says good no matter what. You know, good. It's always good. And he helps people by doing that. But Myoku doesn't understand his good. And you know, then he goes to Nansen, and Nansen says, wrong, you're totally wrong. And Myoku says, how is this possible? I sit down and I'm in enlightened mind, all problems are solved. And Nansen says, not so fast. What about everything else? Right? Well, you can't have individual enlightenment. You know, roll up your sleeves and get to work. Roll up your sleeves and get to work. Otherwise, it's destruction. Right? Then you turn in. Otherwise, you'll turn into one of these teachers who lives in a beautiful house in Antelope, Oregon, and has a fleet of Rolls Royces. And every morning when you drive out in your Rolls Royce, your students will do this, lined up along the road. And you think, how does people get like that? How does that happen, right? Because they're blocking, right? Their enlightenment is incomplete, right? Meoku's enlightenment is incomplete. You can't have the Buddha without having Kosala invade Shakya, the Shakya Republic. You can't have the Buddha without Devadatta. You can't have, you know, one thing without all the other things, because they're all interconnected. So your enlightenment is not your enlightenment. It's like you're part of a process. Everything is waking up together. Your job in this process is to help that process continue. So, you know, what Meoku needs to do is get back to his temple and start helping people wake up and quit fooling around, right, basically. Quit running around with his pilgrim staff, making a spectacle of himself, and do some hard work, right? Get to the hard work of sitting on the cushion with your legs hurting, covered with sweat. People are going to come into the Dokusan room and you're thinking, how can I help them wake up? I don't know what to do. And you lie awake at night and think, oh, I don't know how to help this person. Now you're practicing the great way. Now you're following the Buddha, right? Now you're following the Buddha. So it's okay to worry. Is where I'm going with this, right? It's okay to sweat. Right? It's okay to sweat. You know, a great Zen master in China said, you know, everybody wants to hear about the great Zen masters of the age. Nobody wants to hear about the sweating horses, right? In other words, to get to a Linji, to get to a Dansen, it took generations of hard work. You know, it's hard work. Waking up is hard work. Making the world a better place is hard work. Everybody wants to see the Dalai Lama's picture, but nobody wants to think about all the sweating horses that made the Dalai Lama's enlightenment possible. As a sweating horse, I'm happy to help. With subconscious stirrings, images appear. With awareness, ice forms. Even if there are no stirrings and no awareness, you have not escaped from the confinement of the fox's hole, even if you've had enlightenment, if you think it's your enlightenment. If you truly penetrate in your practice and become master of it, you will experience not a trace of obstruction. No, wrong, that's not true. He's leading you around, he's blowing smoke at you right now. You will be like a dragon supported by deep waters, like a tiger that commands its mountain retreat. Yes and no, right? You're going to have problems, okay? Then, if you let go, even tiles and pebbles become illuminating. In other words, if you're willing to be wrong, if you're willing to make mistakes, if you're willing to roll up your sleeves, everything will be alive. Even tiles and pebbles will be like gold. And if you hold fast to your enlightenment, if you cling to your serenity, even gold loses its luster. The koans of the old masters will become tedious. If you don't keep challenging yourself by engaging with the contradictions in this world, the suffering and difficulty in this world, the path will grow tedious. Main subject, Meoku came to Shokei with his bell staff with him. Walked around Shokei's seat three times, shook his staff, ringing the bell, stuck it in the ground, and stood up straight. Shokei said, good. Meoku then came to Nansen, circled Nansen's seat, shook his staff, ringing the bells, and stuck it in the ground, and stood up straight. Nansen said, wrong, wrong, wrong. Meoku said, But wait, Shoke said good, why do you say wrong? Nonsense says Shoke is good, but you are wrong. You are blown about by the wind. That will lead to destruction. So look, don't be afraid of causes and conditions, right? Engage with causes and conditions, but sit in deep bushin. That's the road to awakening and the road after awakening. Setro's verse, this mistake, that mistake, never take them away. In the four seas, the waves subside. 100 rivers flow quietly to the sea. Don't get rid of the mistakes. Don't be afraid of mistakes. The 12 bells of the staff tinkled up high, empty and silent is the road to the gate. No, it's not empty and silent. So he corrects himself. The enlightened person must take medicine for the illness of having no illness. So everything is my medicine. Trump, the crap, the chaos, all of it. It's all medicine. It's all our medicine. So thank you very much for coming to practice today, and I look forward to sitting again very soon. Sitting with you again very soon. Please turn to page 20. I forgot to ring the bell, sorry.